I did.
Well, one thing, I think that if you'll read the minutes of the last two meetings, this was discussed at great length.
Yeah, and I missed the last.
The entire matter. Now, you want to be careful about getting bogged down with these damn public, pardon me, machine. With these public hearings and witnesses, because there are many organizations in this state, as you well know, that could consume all of the time you'll have between now and 1970.
Or 1980.
Well, the thing that occurs to me is they probably ought to be thinking about such things. For instance, I don't know whether there's anyone here or not that has any expert knowledge on this. They tell me that in just a few years, you're going to be able to go to a grocery store with your credit card. You'll stick the credit card in a little slot, and your account will be charged in a bank somewhere. What effect does that have on what we're doing here? There are many new methods in business. The business community is coming up with these things all the time. And I think we ought to take a look maybe 10 or 20 years hence and see what we're doing. Is this going to be general enough to cover all the coming things? This is the sort of information
well,
I think we need.
Well, Ed, I think that you may have a point, but at the same time, this legislature is going to be in session every 2 years and probably every year before too long. And instead of endeavoring to anticipate whether the spacemen are going to come from the moon, let's wait until they come and then amend the statute. But meanwhile, I think that Don has a plan of groups of interested people from every walk of life, so to speak, that we will have an opportunity to get their reactions toward this. Isn't that correct, Don? The mechanics, I'm not certain of.
Yes, now, first of all, with respect to your question, Representative Aldrich, now, of course, what's before you now is just the larceny or theft draft. Now, within the general framework of crimes against property, we're going to get in subsequently into some of these other crimes, some of the fraudulent practices, the fraud-type crimes that would cover illegal use of credit cards and that sort of thing, which is not incorporated in this, but hopefully would be covered in, as we move on to these other property-type crimes. Now, this, then, with respect to your other question, what I thought would be one way of going about this, to solicit the opinion of the other groups and still do it in a manner that is not going to bog us down necessarily, and that is to circulate, for example, circulate copies of what we have now with the Justice Sloan Bar Committee, for example, and say, will you fellas take a look at this and read through it and let us know what you think of it and make your recommendations and that sort of thing. And the district attorneys, let the district attorneys association circulate this. And
I think this is good, but I think we have to wrestle with this and work it into something close to what we think it should be before we solicit the views, either oral or written, of any interested groups, because in line with what Tony said, we're going to be besieged from all sides, and if we're besieged by these interested people before we have really come to grips with the problem ourselves, I think it's going to make our job a little bit harder. I can see an example where in the preliminary draft we've done away with the larceny from the store and larceny from a person distinction. We circulate this among the chiefs, the sheriffs, and the DAs. We're going to receive 500 letters and phone calls, and we're going to be torn this way and that way. So I would think that we better proceed and rework this to a point somewhat acceptable to all of us before we bring in the outside people. Isn't this what you decided pretty much last time?
Yeah, and then reserving any testimony from other groups or the full committee or something like that.
I make this a suggestion. I don't like to be sticking my nose in here. I'm just an onlooker. But what the track meeting mentioned, they had a recess. For instance, when I was looking at this, the definition of a check, page 2, not in the sense of a public hearing, but just get their ideas. I don't know what all was included in the check or a site order or a draft.
I think that would be fine.
I think that would be helpful.
We do have one advantage, and that's that the model penal code people, the Connecticut, the Illinois, the New York, and all of them have plowed the same ground repeatedly and have made the same inquiries. But I do think that something of that nature would be it.
I don't know whether my comments are general enough, but let me make it more quickly. I think before the final draft of the sentence, sir, I will have to get to a draft of the general principles of liability. One problem is this draft uses intent in the criminal, in the theft or larceny section. The model penal code uses purpose. The model penal code simplifies the states of mind down to purpose, knowledge, recklessness, and negligence. Does away with a lot of baggage that goes along with balance and intent. Intent can be intent, general criminal intent, specific intent, and so forth. And maybe there's some merit in that. So I'm not criticizing use of intent, except in the sense that I think it should be considered in that connection before this draft is finalized. This definition of check that's wrong ways, we're going to have to sit around and think off the corner. Checking is any draft, similar title, or thing of money, which is not post-dated with respect to the time of utterance. This is the Hyder case. But now, if it is the Hyder case, now in the Hyder case, the Supreme Court said came out of Hyder. The Supreme Court said if the check is post-dated, but there's no misrepresentation of its post-dated nature, in effect, this is a false promise situation rather than a present or past misrepresentation. So in one part of this proposed code, we say we're going to penalize false representations of one's intended to what one is to do in the future. But here we say we're not going to. So we're internally conflicting. No criticism of Donald. He's done a tremendous job to get us started, but we're going to sit around and think about it. And I think, as a general proposition, I don't know how to do it. The Senator Uturi feels it can be done. I think that if the comments to the model penal code sections could be made available to the subcommittee members, terrifically helpful.
I was going to ask Don to see if he could obtain them or duplicate them if necessary for the subcommittee.
We've obtained all the ones that are still in print. And of the volumes that we did buy, and there are four volumes, only one of them has comments about the theft statutes. And frankly, I don't think they're too helpful, but I think there are others that are available through the library. They have a complete set of comments over at the library. Yes, and I tend to go through those and a few at a time and know what they've talked about, but they're just the verbatim minutes, and they're not indexed or anything.
I'm thinking of this kind of thing. The tentative grants have little textbooks on each subject matter that are just dang helpful, it seems to me. I have a little feeling all the time I'm going to shut myself up because I have a desire to give a little lecture on something about which I may or may not know very much.
An informal discussion of the section.
So I mean that the comments are tentative grants. Maybe they're not read enough of them. Won't be a difficult.
No, I think we can get them. Milbury, in one of the letters, I think there's a reference. I made this inquiry, and
I
have the impression
that they're out of print, and some of them are.
1, 2, 3, and 4 are available, and I forgot what's in 1, 2, 3, and 4. Now, do you want to go back now to specifics with respect to Don's presentation? Go back into the definitions and talk about this specifically. I'm going to suggest that this be our approach. If nobody has any other general comments, but I want to emphasize that if anybody does, let's not hesitate to bring it up, because the sort of thing that Professor Platt raised with respect to the difference between between larceny and theft is a kind of a general thing that I think it's helpful for us to wrestle with right now, because I think it kind of changed the mood of the committee. Some of us hadn't thought about employing the word larceny. As far as I personally was concerned, this dialogue was extremely helpful. And I think more than anything else, what we're going to do today, conference today, and maybe in the next two or three or four meetings of this subcommittee, is to establish a mood or a feel for the very gigantic problem that we're going into. But if there aren't any general comments, let's go back to the definitions. Now, Don, do you agree that this might be a useful mechanical approach to go back into the definitions and talk about them? Or did you have in mind some other approach with respect to our considerations?
Well, no, I didn't have any other approach in mind. I think that it's asking quite a bit of all of you here today to, without having had the benefit of going through and really studying these things and comparing these various drafts with each other, to comment even upon my definitions. But at the same time, I welcome any suggestions or criticisms of what's here before you today. Now, I didn't really anticipate that at this meeting, Mr. Chairman, that we'd be able to get down to the real brass tacks of saying, well, we like this and let's keep that, or we don't like this, let's reject that. I really didn't expect we would get that far, and I'm sure you don't either, but the main thing that I hope to do, and whether we continue, and you want to go back through these definitions, is certainly fine with me, but the main thing I wanted to do was hit you with this thing today and see what you thought about it, and then discuss any aspect of it that the members wanted to talk about from any standpoint. And there is a page in here in which back in the comments under the second larceny section, in which I had set forth on page 1I, a comparison of some of the major differences between the Model Penal Code, the New York Penal Law, and the Illinois Criminal Code, which I think might be helpful at this stage, so that we get an idea of some of the significant ways in which these codes differ from one another.
Right. Why don't we all turn to page 1I and read that?
All right, now.
Now,
both the New York Revised Penal Law and the Illinois Code contain more complete definitions of the offenses that would constitute larceny. Now, I might mention this right at this point, too. You'll notice that on your blue page, it shows the Model Penal Code draft of larceny, that there's some handwritten changes that appear in there in the final draft. Changes that are shown in the front of the book reflect that, and you'll notice that under section 223.1 of the Model Penal Code, after offense, in the second line, in subparagraph 2, they have deleted the rest of that sentence, which even more limits their definition of theft, because they've taken out the language embracing the separate offenses known as larceny, embezzlement, falsity. That at their final meeting, they decided to eliminate that. So the New York Code, I felt, was a better approach, because it and the Illinois Code too was better, because they more fully defined the type of conduct that would be got your everything defined yet thoroughly. Now, another difference was with respect to the language in defining larceny of lost or mislaid property. And these are rather subtle distinctions, but there is some substance to them. Now, the New York Code says a person acquires lost property when he exercises the control over property of another without taking reasonable measures to return such property to the owner. The Illinois Code states that the person who obtains control over lost or mislaid property commits theft when he fails to take reasonable measures to restore the property to the owner and intends to deprive the owner permanently of the use or benefit of the property.
All right, let's stop right there. Can we? I underline this when I went through it. They don't define reasonable measures to restore the property, do they? I assume that probably Illinois, there's good reason for them to, there was good reason for them to use this, but is this opening up? Well, this is opening up something for judicial interpretation. Is it pretty loose language, or is it not?
Well, they've all used the language reasonable measures. They've all used that, and a little different. I mean, one of them says reasonable measures to return it to a person entitled to have it.
We don't employ this language anywhere in the present argument, do we?
Well, first I'm going out of turn here.
No.
I'm wondering if with this particular problem, if the members, I use my language, if the members of the subcommittee are keenly aware of what kind of a change of the law is contemplated here. This is a change in the criminal law of finders as opposed to the civil law of finders, which has to do with who winds up with the title after you advertise or this kind of thing. But this is, if you find something, under what circumstances are you a thief? This is one of the criminal law teaching devices, and it's a real complicated deal from a teaching device. Under the present law, as I understand it, if I find something and there's no clue to the ownership of it, it doesn't have somebody's name on it, or a serial number, or it isn't $1,000 bill, of course you find by an ad in the paper that somebody lost that. If I find something with no clue to ownership on it, and I appropriate it to my own use, I'm not guilty of a larceny crime. Now, if I find something where there is a clue to ownership and I pick it up, intending at that time to return it to the true owner, I'm not guilty of larceny because I had no intent to steal when I picked it up. But if I later form the intent to appropriate, maybe I'm guilty of something else. I'm not guilty of embezzlement presently because I had no relationship of servant, agent, trustee, and so forth. Maybe I'm guilty of larceny by a bailee, but it's an extremely complex technical thing. This does away with all kinds of distinctions like this and says that if I acquire a lost property and don't try to get it back to the owner, then I'm guilty of a crime. So it's an entirely different approach to a problem. I think it's a good approach. It's an approach that Washington has already had by statute, that the Model Penal Code suggests. But I wondered if we were aware that this is an entirely different approach to a basic larceny problem. And this is the first thing. This is one reason why I think these comments to the Model Penal Code are so dang helpful, because they point out why this is a complete change in the law. It's a good change, and it's a piece of law that doesn't come up very often. This isn't very socially important, I don't suppose. It's law teacher's kind of law, you know what I mean? Some of the social importance stuff is checks and all this. This is highly technical. So we should be aware of what we're doing when we do something highly technical. It seems to me.
You're going a little bit further than saying you don't try. You don't reasonably try. It is extremely technical. It seems to me that it's good. I would anticipate. I can see problems with it, but.
Well, you leave it to the jury to determine.
You let the jury decide, and probably this is the way it should be. But I sure agree that the comments on the draft would probably answer some questions
we
that they may have. All right, Don, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's quite all right. Now, paragraph 3, third difference regarding the larceny by extortion. And my draft follows New York law in prescribing the larceny of property by threat to cause physical injury to some person in the future. The Model penal code makes it largely to purposely obtain property of another by threatening to inflict bodily injury on anyone. The New York provision distinguishes, I think, more clearly between this kind of larceny and a more serious offense of robbery. The Illinois code punishes as theft the conduct of the person who obtains by threat control of the property of another, and then the term threat is further defined as proving a menace to inflict physical harm on the person threatened or any other person. Now, I think it's a minor distinction, but I think that, that the New York code makes it more clear that we're not talking about an imminent threat, a threat to do harm right now, which would be robbery. But we're talking about a threat to inflict bodily harm in the future on the person threatened or on some other person, either larceny by extortion. Then a fourth difference exists in connection with the methods that they set out, criteria used to determine the value of stolen property. The model penal code simply states that the amount involved in the theft shall be deemed to be the highest value by any reasonable standard of the property or services which the actor stole or attempted to steal. The New York code sets out three definite criteria that I have used also, and the Illinois code does not include a section.
Two separate items. Going back to the lost and mislaid property, the phrase is used reasonable measure. Now, I don't want to direct my remarks specifically to this because I agree with Courtney that this is not a socially important problem, but it has overtones that we're going to be coming across on many things, and that's the word reasonable. Now, what does it mean when someone reasonably tries to return the property? Does it mean reasonable in the eyes of the person trying to do it, a subjective test, or does it mean the objective man test? And I raise the point here because we're going to run across the subjective-objective conflict throughout. And the Model Penal Code itself, is my impression, overall, presents the subjective test in many cases, and I think now of self-defense, some of the justification crimes. Words of the Model Penal Code are as the person sees it in light circumstances to make it much more subjective. Well, I raise that issue now because I think we ought to focus on it as we're looking at all the aspects of criminal law and what we do mean by what is reasonable. Reasonable within the eyes of the actor or reasonable within the detached view of the old objective man test. And the second thing I want to comment on relates to a much more specific point now on the determination of value of property. And I refer now to page 2B, subsections A and B. Now I raise the problem that I think is socially important, and that is the credit card. How do we determine the value of a credit card? Well, it would seem to fall under subsection B on page 2B, the value of any other instrument, because we talk about evidence of debt such as a check above. So I assume B, sub B, would be applied to the credit card. And there it says that it shall be deemed the greatest amount of economic loss which the owner might reasonably suffer because of the loss of the instrument. Now, my Bank of America allows me to spend $500, I think, before they tell me that I can't use it anymore. But I wonder if that really is the value that this means. Because in the law of credit cards, there aren't too many cases on it, but in some cases it's held that you're liable for any amount that the thief may run up before you give notice. In some cases, you're not liable at all, depending on whether your signature has been on the card and so forth. But the point I raise is that perhaps, actually, the value of that card is going to fall under 3 rather than sub B. Because when I get a credit card, I agree that I'll give immediate notice when I lose it, so that my liability will end if the thief uses it. Well, in a sense, then, it doesn't have any economic value.
made some good comments on this section. Just a minute. I'm going to go on to something else. I'll have this here in just a minute.
In any event, I don't think we should insulate ourselves from expert opinion on this, because we're probably right in the midst of converting from a check-oriented economy to a credit card economy.
You've got case law on quite a bit of this on credit cards, though, except the new you have on gasoline, telephone, to the extent of liability. Of course, this is civil.
We have two distinct problems, though, with respect to credit cards. The little girl that I recently represented that had a stolen credit card in her possession and hadn't used it certainly wasn't as guilty of an offense as the professional hood that had one and used it. And I'm just wondering to say that the unauthorized possession of a stolen credit card constitutes a felony, or, you know, an aggravated offense. I'm wondering if this isn't cutting straws. What basically did it deal with?
Well, with respect to these tests that New York had employed were determining value, I don't think there was anything specifically about credit cards or anything like that in their comments, but I do believe, my recollection is that this represents pretty much a codification of the existing case law in the state of Oregon.
I don't know just exactly how to move on from this point. Do you have a concrete suggestion with respect to the problem?
No, I don't. Right. I must confess that I don't know. I haven't really thought about the problem until I began reading the language here.
Well, a credit card has no value in and of itself. But it lends itself to obtaining money by false pretenses or other things of value. And wouldn't it be logical to handle it on the basis of that, an intent, having a credit card with intent to use it to obtain money or other property by false pretenses or credit before there is any?
My offhand inclination would concur with that, and if that were the case, then the manner in which Don has drafted this with respect to the presumption of value doesn't constitute any problem. I can see where the retail interests might descend on us en masse, as you suggested. But can't see where the police would have any objection to our approach to this end, because we're not changing the law as it presently is. We don't make it a specific crime or a specific degree of.
I think the law as it presently is what they're the objection.
if you have the degrees of crime in larceny and 100 other kind of crimes you're going to be talking about, you're going to be right back again finding all kinds of different kinds of punishments. And the only thing, as I would view it, that the degree of the crime has to do with it is what the punishment will be. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the way the legislature set up.
And the same way with the amount that's involved. Well, is it feasible and worthwhile to consider trying to find some other means of defining the seriousness of offense by some means other than the amount of money or by degree?
Well, you do, as we say, if you steal it from a store.
But you can't go through in a code like this and say stealing from a store is one thing, stealing from a railroad depot is something else, stealing from the law.
That's exactly what we're trying to do.
We're trying to avoid. And is it possible to define it rather than by degrees, by some concept that has to do with aggravation, or some other word like concept?
You have an observation on that?
No, I'm just sitting here.
You're commenting on a thought that's been running through my mind, and I haven't been able to come to grips with the answer. Don?
Well, I'd just like to make this observation. Of course, as this commission grapples with the problem of what type of conduct is going to be criminal to start with, it's then also going to have to face the decision of what type of conduct is going to be criminal and yet more serious in nature than some other type of conduct.
And how we describe it, yeah.
We're going to have, possibly, as some of the codes have done, two or three different types of felons, class A, B, or C, for example, or 1, 2, and 3. And deciding then, in a general manner, that this type of conduct, because of the serious nature of it involving threat of bodily harm or death to someone, is going to be the highest type of felon. And then another type is going to be a little lower, and then down into your misdemeanor structure. And then once we've made that decision, then applying this criteria to a larceny crime, we can then say this fits into class A, B, or C.
Well, is that, again, I'm seeing where I'm very likely I'm getting into an element of philosophy that doesn't. You have not yet reached the question of policy, but when you categorize degrees of crime or in some other way in which the sentencing authority is bound to say, okay, you get 10 years, I have no choice in this. When 10 years may be wholly inappropriate, are you going to continue to have legislatively determined, predetermined sentences for various categories of offense based on a category that is fixed? Or are you going to leave to the sentencing authority this determination of how serious actually was this? What should happen to this man?
Well, for example, Judge, now, New York has a chart which sets forth felony classifications in prison terms. Class A felony, minimum maximum terms, reformatory imprisonment, not permitted, permissible definite term, not permitted. That's Class A. Then it runs down the line, Class B felony, Class C felony. And then applying this formula, for example, when you move over into petty larceny. Petty larceny, they say, is a Class A misdemeanor. Or grand larceny in the third degree is a Class E felon. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but
this
is an approach.
I say, is this the correct approach? And it actually, this involves more than just the amount of sentence, for instance, but at what level of these offenses do all of your constitutional rights attach?
We're getting into an area. We're getting into an area of philosophy with respect to corrections, which of course transcends the whole question of criminal law revision. One of the things that's given impetus to this.
See, if you're going to have five or six different degrees of larceny, and then you have five or six different degrees of robbery, and degrees of murder and any number of other crimes and so forth, each one of which gets into a category of it's a class A felony or a class B felony and so forth. But you're going to have, seems to me, like the same problem in sentencing, attachment of constitutional rights, loss of civil rights, all the other things that go with it.
Well, we're never going to, neither this commission or anyone else is ever going to read something which is theoretically pure or philosophically pure or perfect, because it all depends from the standpoint of rehabilitation or anything. It all depends upon the point of view of the person who is examining it or looking at it.
Every set of facts is different.
Yeah.
And you have...
Yeah, well, let me bring up something. I think this is the time to bring it up. And that is something I probably would think of. Right now, you have various actions that the police can take based on whether they're dealing with a misdemeanor or felony, certain actions they take on service of warrants, the degree of force and arrest and that sort of thing, that are hinged primarily on whether a crime is a misdemeanor or a felony. And if you go into various degrees here, you're going to have to do some spelling out. It's going to be very complicated if you go into a large number of degrees of crimes, unless you have some place where you can draw the line, because remember, you're dealing with people on the street who are affecting these arrests. Some of them in these little cities don't really know what you mean by...
But you'll still have the difference between misdemeanor and felony, you see.
You still have this distinction on what you...
Regardless of the degree.
Want to be sure that was still in your thinking.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point. I want to make an observation on that in a minute. Professor Arnold?
Well, I don't want to get ahead of the center, but I want to make an observation along those same lines. It seems to me, in a sense, that perhaps we don't have too much to do with the point at which certain constitutional rights attach. Now, in Schmerber, in 1966, in June, the court stated bluntly that the Fourth Amendment search and seizure provisions applied to driving under the influence as a misdemeanor. That it didn't make a difference whether it was a felony or a misdemeanor. Now, they've held in the course of this year that the Fourth Amendment applies in that kind of a quasi-civil, quasi-criminal situation where you're charged with a misdemeanor because you didn't let the fire marshal make an inspection without a warrant. I'm suggesting that the tenor of the recent United States Supreme Court decisions is that the constitutional rights will apply regardless of the degree of the crime. And we spent yesterday trying to determine... I'm just be very careful what I say now, because the court has it under consideration whether the right to assign counsel for indigence applies at what stage along the line. So we may find ourselves with all the constitutional rights eventually applying wherever there's imprisonment, for instance. I'm not sure then that what we're doing really will establish whether constitutional rights apply to that extent. Secondly, getting back to that check thing, I feel terribly embarrassed because I'm not coming up with a thing on that. But I would like to know, for instance, and here's where I think the commission is desperately handicapped by lack of money, because we're handicapped for lack of immediate research. We ought to know, for instance, what is done with the bad check situation under the New York situation. What are some actual cases that have arisen? What has actually happened in Illinois? What has actually happened in Michigan with the credit card situation? And also, what are some of the recent law review articles on how to handle the credit card situation? We're doing a pretty good job, but you see, I have a higher opinion of your intelligences than I have of mine. I feel inadequate in the area. I would like to know what some other guy has said.
Two observations. I think it is a fact that the distinctions between the constitutional application is rapidly diminishing as far as felonies and misdemeanors is concerned. I don't think there's any question that the gap is
John, I'm not so sure that the constitutional application will be the same 10 years from now
as
what it is today.
But when we start talking about degrees of crime and we start talking about the overall revision problem, I keep going back to the United States Constitution, which is infinitely shorter than the infinitely more simple than the Oregon Constitution, and has been amended infinitely fewer times. And I'm wondering if our best approach to this problem isn't our most simple approach. By necessity, we have to break these things into degrees, at least insofar as a felony concerns on one hand and a misdemeanor on the other. But I wonder if we just don't compound the problem when we start breaking it into degrees of misdemeanors and degrees of felonies. An aggravated misdemeanor or a plain misdemeanor, like they have in New York, for example. Now, obviously, there's been a lot of work, a lot of study on this, and there's a rationale for the contrary opinion. But my thought is the simplest approach is the best approach. What's the committee think?
Senator, I'm speaking out of turn, Senator. I'm not a member of the committee to the commission, but let me respond very quickly. This one thing, I don't know which is the right way to do it, but I think that we're kind of in the dark in that we haven't yet read the Model Penal Code apology or rationale for why it was done this way and why this is, of course, why New York has done it, why Illinois has done it, why Michigan has done it, or if they have, I think they have. And I feel in the dark to that extent. I'm not arguing one way or the other, but we need to know those arguments.
John, you're going to be in trouble if you don't try to distinguish in degrees to a certain extent, it appears to me. If you want to make it purely simple, you wouldn't have any distinction between felonies and misdemeanors. An offense is an offense, regardless if you steal $1 or $100,000. But from a practical and a social point of view, it seems to me that one of the things that perhaps we shouldn't keep in mind, but actually has a bearing upon the decision of all of the states, is the realistic matter of how are you going to dispose of these criminal proceedings. Supposing that there was no choice anywhere along the line, whether you stole a dollar or $100,000, if it's in the theft field, the district attorney, the court, nobody else ever had any choice. You'd have cases piled up for 10 years because everyone would be a plea of not guilty. And I honestly think that one of the reasons for the degree is to try to do justice as much as possible, giving the defendant the benefit of the doubt, and secondly, to relieve the congested docket so that there can be this very plea bargaining that we discussed before. If we don't, we're going to be in a fine kettle of fish. And I suspect that to some extent there's an element of justice and the other of practicality and expediency that has prompted a great deal of this. Plus the fact that the those who are interested in correction and reform and rehabilitation have had a hand in it also. And from that point of view, I would think that the parole boards or those who are entrusted with rehabilitation and sending men back to society are placed in a little better position if there are these degrees and so on. Now that's just a thought, I don't know. I think there's something to it.
Well, I don't think there's any question that there is something to it. And we're handicapped, I guess, because we don't have the benefit of the apology or rationale behind the movement that's culminating in this change. I want to bring up some specifics. A question, and I think I will right now to try to keep this moving. We talked earlier this morning about checks. And Ed, you mentioned if we make an arbitrary cutoff on period of time, it's more aggravated. There is legislation like this that was introduced and passed in the 65 session of the Washington legislature. There was some effort to introduce it here in Oregon, but it didn't really materialize. Don, had you given in your draft any consideration to that sort of, specific statutory approach to reach the problem that Ed brought up?
No, I didn't. I didn't give any consideration to that approach.
Do you think that, why? Because you think that that's just creating another special interest type of statute, the thing that we're trying to get away from, or?
Well, simply this. When I set out to get this initial draft down on paper, I made certain basic decisions to start with. Number one, that I could not, from a practical standpoint, one person examine all of these possibilities and still get something down here in the time allotted to consider. So I said, I've got the model penal code, I have the New York revised penal law, and the Illinois code. I'm going to look at those three, all of which have been widely used and widely recognized as good, sound approaches, and attempt to come up with a tentative draft here that is going to take the best from all of these. And frankly, I didn't even consider the Kansas approach, nor Georgia, I understand, has a new code. I didn't consider Georgia. And there are any number of them that you could consider, but it seems to me that we're going to have to just out of hand limit ourselves to a certain extent here. Otherwise, frankly, I'm a little pessimistic about the kind of progress we're going to make here. We have some practical limitations here, and some practical limitations, not just with time, but resources.
Chairman,
yeah.
I think I can tell you why that bill wasn't introduced in 1965. Made a hasty poll of the House Judiciary Committee and decided against it.
Glad you said House, not the Senate.
As practical as that.
You gentlemen remember the legislature. If you remember the study that the Board of Control initiated a couple of years ago on the bed check problem, that's a terrific mind resource on the thing, whether it's good, bad, or different. A lot of credit people were involved, a lot of prosecutors, identity, people from corrections, and there's a lot of history of the problem, a lot of opposite views. We should take a look, good, long, hard look before we jump on that. Maybe we can't go immediately. Or you, I think out there.
Very controversial.
Well, now, you were going over this, forget where you were.
On the comparisons?
Yeah.
I think I pretty well completed that, Mr. Chairman. And on all that was to hit the high points of differences between these three approaches. Now, the approach I've taken is just one man's view here as to a possible approach to a larceny statute or a theft statute. And I couldn't agree more with Professor Arthur when he says that we certainly need to examine the rationale behind some of these other approaches that have been taken to this problem. But I think that we need to examine the rationale within the framework of something concrete that we can look at and examine. And it may well be that before this subcommittee is through with this, that it'll be completely different. That's fine with me. The point is that I think we need to have words down here in black and white so we can have just this kind of of exchange that we've had here this morning. Let me
drag out one more specific here at the risk of boring everybody with talking too much. On your comparison on 1I, the third paragraph where we went over it in our draft, with respect to extortion, and consider statutes of general application, and you were talking about intent and malice and purpose and so on. We have in our preamble, so to speak, of the Oregon Criminal Code, those statutes relating now to attempt, for example, the crime which, or the statute which makes it a crime by threatening to commit a felony, and those other preliminary sections. Do I understand that we're envisioning, or that, doing away with these other sections that we have? And if we're not, are we going into redundancies by, on the one hand, having a specific section that makes it a crime to threaten to commit a felony, or a general statute, a general attempt statute, and then going here in the this specific area and making it a crime to threaten to inflict bodily injury? You see the problem that I raised?
Well, yes, but let me say this. When I said no, we're not going to do away with those, I think that we may alter them somewhat, and when these preliminary articles are drafted, it's going to amount to a restatement of some of these principles. I don't really think that by restating some of these fundamental principles that will apply throughout the criminal code, that it is going to prevent us from adopting certain approaches to, say, the crime of stealing. In other words, I think that we have the cart before the horse a little bit here with a specific section, a specific substantive crime here, when we have not yet made some of these basic policy decisions. But I don't think it's an overwhelming obstacle. I think that this will be modified later to fit these policy decisions that are yet to be made, and that when we finally have this all put together, that what we have, say, in the section dealing with crimes against property would be consistent with whatever provisions are set forth in our preliminary articles. And
that's why Professor Archer said a little while ago he was a little bit embarrassed that this was here before some of the material that he's working on, which are the very things that you're discussing.
Another thing, let me say this. I think maybe again we've got a problem of two different things. One, the preliminary part, the general provisions apply to criminal law generally. But I think Senator Burns was referring to specific substantive crimes of the attempt crimes, the solicitation crimes, conspiracy crimes, and so forth. We will have in the substantive crimes some of these other crimes, which we're kind of mixing into larceny here. We'll have a general attempt statute with some general material on that. Is that what you're suggesting? Is that if we have that general attempt statute, we should be careful not to mix too much of that into this?
I'm just really thinking out loud and trying to crystallize my thoughts.
Of course, what you're really talking about, though, here, when you say that extortion amounts to larceny, you're talking about a completed crime that has been committed. The crime of larceny has been committed by extortion, by threat. In other words, A threatens B to part with property, and B does part with property, and that equals larceny. And this was the point of my earlier comment when I said, well, this does not reflect our present extortion statute, because our present extortion statute is really an attempt. I mean, that's a threat without anything else. It doesn't matter. In fact, there's an Oregon case that I cite, I believe, in one of these cases in my comments here, that says this is not, it doesn't matter. I'll take that back. I didn't cite that case. I didn't get to, but I do have a note here about, in fact, it's in one Oregon 140, 1854 case. The threat is the gist of the crime, and the intent of the actor constitutes the offense without reference to the effect produced on the party threatened. It doesn't matter whether the party parts with any property or not. Just the threat itself is the crime of extortion under our statute. But this would not be extortion as it's defined in this larceny draft. because here you would need the completed action on the part of the person being threatened. He did give up some property as a result of this threat. So what we're thinking of now is larceny in our present statute would be really maybe an attempted larceny by extortion, perhaps. I don't know.
I can see why California said that considering anything less than 6 years or perhaps more was highly optimistic in this field.
Every time I open my mouth, I feel presumptuous that I want to shut up here for a reason. But I wonder, one of your big problems, Senator, is going to be, what do you do to prepare for the next meeting of this subcommittee? I'm just stretching around. I'm not a member of the subcommittee. I'm not assigned to this problem, and so I'm talking way out of time. But it's going to be true of all the subcommittees. I'm wondering if it would be feasible to take, say, the material on page 2, larceny, preliminary draft larceny, where you define larceny, a certain hunk of that. I don't know how big a hunk, but a certain hunk of that. And now the committee has the draft before them. Before the next meeting, each member of the committee study it carefully. And that if there would be a possibility of getting the comments from the Model Penal Code to it circulated. And some more research done on how it would affect the local law. And then the next time when you meet, you would be addressing yourself to a more limited portion. And I know this is dangerous because already we need to have an overview of the whole code, don't we, when you raise that attempt problem.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, you've got to have some place to start.
I'm wondering, you really hit the nail on the head when you said that one of the problems what we're going to have for our next meeting. I'm wondering if the whole committee of all of us here couldn't look at 1A, look at page 1A now in the book, to try and place in perspective exactly...
Under definition?
No, under larceny, I'm sorry. To try to place in perspective exactly what Don has been trying to do with this tentative draft, how all encompassing this proposed new statute is. We'll just go down these pages here.
That's Exhibit A.
Yeah.
Yes, right. See that all of these sections are statutes that we're going to do away with. We're going to repeal, are we not?
Yeah.
Is this not true?
With respect to Exhibit A, I think I'm on fairly safe ground to say that if this draft were enacted in its present form, it would repeal probably 98% of what appears on that page. In setting out all those, I did not necessarily mean to imply that they would all be repealed, the same with Exhibit B and C. What I was attempting to do was to set forth the statutes that deal with this type of conduct now, and to show you that the wide variety of different statutory crimes with the wide variety of penalties, and I have a list which is not in the book of the statutes that would be repealed. And on Exhibit A, now here again, I should mention this, that this is a job that before this ever went into bill form, all of these would have to be checked very closely through legislative council to make sure that everything has been covered, all the existing statutes. Now, under 164, certainly 310 would be repealed, 320, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, down through through 80 and 390. I left with the shoplifting statute. And we do have these other provisions in there about false arrest and whatnot. Ultimately, if this larceny law were finally put together, I think that that might be repealed. But as it stands now, I would say not necessarily would we want to repeal the shoplifting statute, because this draft does not really cover all the things that are now in the shoplifting statute. And in the same way, down through your chapters in 164 and 165. So, but I felt that at this stage of things, that to try to indefinitely say that all these statutes were going to be repealed would be presumptuous, although certainly your basic embezzlement statutes would be repealed by this draft, your basic larceny statutes would be repealed, and your basic statutes dealing with obtaining would be repealed. Go that far. Your theft of services would repeal some of these other things that appear, for example, in Exhibit C, defrauding an innkeeper, for example, that type of thing. But we have such a wide variety of different crimes here that, for example, we have things such as abandonment of animals by bailees, conversion of animals, adulterating gold dust. I mean, this type of thing, it's a little hard when you sit down to draft the statute and say, it's going to take care of all these. I can't really tell you at this point that all of these would be repealed by the statute.
The poor cab driver is the only one that isn't protected very much.
Better not do anything about gold dust, or this being an election year, I could make a party about your town. We're running head-on into some of these malicious destruction type offenses, too. And I suppose this is going to be a separate section.
Let me say this, but with respect to A, B, and C, I would think by the time we are through the section of our restatement dealing with crimes against property, that we should, if we do the job the way we should do it, that all of these in A, B, and C will be repealed. And they will be covered somewhere in the comprehensive section dealing with crimes against property, not just the larceny or theft section, but either your fraud crimes or some of your other types of larcenous conduct, which isn't necessarily larceny,
this
would be covered in crimes against property.
This subcommittee is charged with responsibility of all crimes against property, right?
Well, at this point, no. The only thing that's been assigned is the theft statute.
Right. And the malicious destruction type statutes haven't been assigned yet.
No. But I would anticipate that, say, when this subcommittee finishes with the draft of the larceny law, that it would move in, say, into robbery or move into some of these other areas. It would seem logical.
Dealing with property,
yes.
I want to congratulate you on that assumption, Don, that we'll finish with that.
Yeah.
Courtney, I want to say that or maybe John intended to say this, that we don't want either you or George or Gordon or anybody else to feel reluctant to express yourselves, because we actually want you to participate in all of this, and I'm sure that every member of the subcommittee, this and others, welcome that. So feel absolutely free at all times.
I'm negligent in not expressing that, because it's been tremendously helpful to those of us who are members to hear you out on these things, and don't be hesitant at all.
May I ask a question in respect to the matter of drafting and
we have a Uniform Commercial Code, and you see the treatment that's been given to some of the commentaries in that. They haven't been particularly followed. And I know as far as the legislature itself is concerned, well, the court quite often refers to the committee minutes, but I don't know how much weight the court has to give to them. My own feeling would be that we're on much safer ground placing it in the statute rather than relying upon a statement of intent of a commission or a committee or anything else, because it could well be that there would be a disagreement in some lawsuit between members of a committee as what the statement of intent was, and etc. That's just my personal feeling, and I think that's the way the legislature has looked at statements of intent in the past.
When Justice Snow raises a very difficult point, certainly. I'm going to the area now of deciding when is the statute void of vagueness, really. How brief and general can a statute be without transcending the constitutional limits on what the vagueness doctrine? And it's a matter of degree. I have a tendency to agree with Senator Curry that there ought to be more than just subsection 1. Just from that standpoint of the, maybe this one would be all right on the ground that it's not vague enough, that it's not too vague. But I'm afraid that if we once establish that policy throughout of generalizing, emphasizing the general rather than and excluding any kind of specifics, that we would run into that trouble somewhere along the line and might imperil part of the code. And here again, I'm not at the same time saying that we should specify to the degree that we have, perhaps by saying limited to, or including but not limited to, that kind of specificity, I'm not so sure is too worthwhile. This comes back to the conversation we had before.
The thing that I want to read, the reason I ask the question is when we go home and study this, so what are we looking for? What kind of at least generalized guidelines at this time should we look to that would be helpful to us in deciding, well, this is or isn't necessary, or this can be simplified, as John suggested.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to Judge Stone's statement also? Again, perhaps I'm too rigid and I'm looking for an easy way out sometimes, but it seems to me that to the extent that the commission can actually bind, to the extent that the commission is convinced that it's good, the model penal code or a distillation of the model penal code in New York and so forth is a good idea. And this would also follow the degree of specificness that you get to in doing it would be, if that could be followed. Not because it's good or bad in itself, but here we've got a subject that's been a hodgepodge of 50 states. And to the degree that we can start in this country with communications and transportation throughout the whole country together, to the degree that we can achieve a degree of uniformity in this area, we'll be well off, just as in the commercial code and so forth. So to the extent that you can buy the model penal code approach, that it doesn't trample on special interest or do a socially wrong thing, to the degree that you can buy it, and to the degree that you can have the same degree of specificness, that you'll get a whole lot of built-in case comment all over the country that will be extremely helpful to me. So this is an argument, at least, in following what Don has done and what the other code has done. It's simply an argument, I think it's good.
Okay. Do you want to pick that up, Don, or do you have any comments to make with regard to that?
Well, no, I have no comment, particularly in response to that point. I think that we go through this is going to have a little different perspective on this. And of course, that's good. And my thought was that each of us would, when we've been given an opportunity to study this more carefully, could then make his own particular comments and his own suggestions with respect to what's down here and how it could be strengthened or changed.
codify it. And with that being the case, what specific sections would you, of the ORS, would you envision that we're going to repeal? Write those down and distribute those so that I know I will do it informally as I go through it. Probably everybody else will too. But we'll have the benefit of your research.
Yeah, I have such a list now, and I didn't get it completed in time to have it incorporated in this pamphlet, but I think I have them pretty well covered, but this is the type of research and cross-checking that you'd have to have several people taking a look at it, not just one person, because it's too easy to overlook something. Besides that, you get into some of these regulatory offenses that when you first look at them, you think, well, they're not really affected, but some of these that maybe aren't necessarily...
This is an area where a legislative counsel's office is extremely useful. One of my colleagues from the Illinois Legislative Reference Bureau refers to it as peripheral vision. And the statutory expert develops that to a degree the rest of us do not have. And you're never going to be sure, Don. As hard as you try, no matter how valid your effort is, you're never going to be sure whether you collected all these things are going to be affected. And even after the legislative counsel gets through, he's not going to be sure. But this is an area where there are specialists that I think ought to be relied on at this point, if possible.
I don't see any reason why we can't call on legislative counsel.
Oh, we can.
Well, there is. There isn't. As a matter of fact, legislative counsel, one of the things that Kathleen Beaufay's been doing is she has gone through the entire model penal code to correlate the model penal code provisions with our existing criminal statutes that appear in 161 through 168. And at the same time, trying to pick up anything else that might be in some other chapters. So they are doing that at this point, but that's just part of the task. From there, then you have to then decide whether or not what you have drafted is going, what effect it's going to have on these particular sections that are existing law now. I mean, saying that the model penal code corresponds to in one section to a certain section of ORS does not necessarily tell you whether that's going to be amended or repealed or just what special action is going to have to be taken on the existing law. But I couldn't agree more that this is an area that legislative counsel is going to be very helpful and has been up to now. Just don't, no question about it.
Let me jump to something else. Started out with the definitions wherever they were, page 2, larceny definitions, and we have these definitions, and then we get over into the preliminary draft on larceny, and we go from that to receiving stolen property, issuing a bad check, larceny of services. Now, it was your intention, and I assume it's the intention of the other, or the models that you use, to make these definitions on page 2 applicable right down the line to receiving, washing services, etc. Is this not right? Okay. Can I get the sense of the committee on this? And I have to apologize to you because my own expounding here is a darn fragmented. But wouldn't it be more workable or better? I agree that the definition should apply right straight across the board, no question about that. And I think we're each individually going to have to examine these and try to place them in perspective. But I'm wondering, Don, if we shouldn't go on and after larceny of
automobiles. Now, I mentioned earlier, at least I thought I had, that I felt there should be a section in here with that covered such things as taking and using. I just didn't get to it. I think it definitely, I agree with it, should be in there. Yeah. Same way, I think that we should have something in there about affirmative defenses, but I haven't got that in there yet either.
I'm thinking, Tony, how we're going to bridge the gap between where we are now and where we're going to take up at the next meeting. And I think it's up to the committee to try to give Don some sense of direction. We're obviously not in a position to do that because, speaking for myself, coming into this fairly cold, and he's been wrestling with it, and way ahead.
Well, John, I actually think that what's going to be required is that you're going to have another meeting with this subcommittee, having given them an adequate time to dwell upon this and study it. And it's probable that you'll have to go over the same ground that we have today to a certain extent before you ever make any conclusions. I don't think that you're going to bridge anything. Personally, I feel that it's well to discuss all of these things, but I think perhaps that you'll achieve a great deal more if you let everyone dwell upon this and call a meeting, Portland or here, 2 weeks or whenever you feel, and re-examine this whole position, including these things that you have mentioned. Meanwhile, I think Don will know of your views or some of the questions that have arisen sufficiently so that he'll be prepared to discuss and perhaps even have something prepared in those areas for you. It's pretty hard right now to be real specific as to what you're going to do at that next meeting, it seems to me.
Further discussion of what we've discussed this morning in the light of our sleeping on.
You would agree that that's the best approach for us?
Yes, I would think so.
Is there anything specific that you would like to charge Don with investigating so that he can bring it or maybe focus on it?
I have a specific question that's kind of plagued me since I've read this, and the use of the word permanently deprive somebody of their property. Seems to me like that could be a troublesome word.
There's an awful lot of common law history and case law on that. I've got to run across the street and it's raining like sin. I think if you're umbrella, my idea is, I'm just going to run across the street and be right back. And I get stumbled all the way over and drop it or something, but I had no intention of permanently depriving. On the other hand, the idea is I take your horse and I go down to the end of the lane and I slap it on the rough and the horse will go right back to the bar. This is no intent of permanently depriving. But if I take your horse and ride to Times Square in New York and slap the horse in the rough, it's not going to go back. There's too great a danger that you'll be permanently deprived there. I think that covered over with a brushing of history and of case law.
It creates no problem.
I think it creates no problem. I think there's a lot of authority